Magic Without Fears, Hermetic Podcast. I'm your host, Frater RC. For more and exclusive episodes, visit magicwithoutfears.com. Thank you for your support.
We're talked here today to talk about spirits and to talk about our experiences with them. So we'll talk about the popular historical and contemporary conceptions of different types of spirits, aliens, extra dimensional entities, poltergeists, shadow people, you name it. We'll discuss that, but mostly I'm going to go through my life and talk about my first experience and cover as much as we can with the time that we have and give you as clear and honest an account that I can of what those experiences were, what I think they might be, and how they shaped my life and helped make and inform the decisions that I made as I went through life having these experiences, which a lot of people have had. Of course, that's one of the most fascinating things about this. As I started to have these experiences myself with the world of the super sensible, of the spiritual creatures or extra dimensional consciousnesses or intelligences, I realized that actually it was the majority of people who have had these experiences in human history and even in modern day. That's one of the most fascinating things about it. It's not like we're talking about something that's actually occult and hidden. The forces themselves may be occult and hidden most of the time, but as we have all seen in the past 5 years with the UAP disclosures and all of that, even our governments are no longer able to just brush it all off. Of course, it provides ample opportunity for them to also spin the stories as they want. But again, none of that is what we're going to focus on. I'm just going to talk to you about the history of my experiences, starting from my first encounter with non-human intelligences. I think these ones were human at one time. That's at least what I was told, but I certainly experienced them. In 1988 was my first experience. So we'll start in 1988 and go from there. How's that sound? So thanks, everyone, for being here. If you're a channel member, Kisa, good to see you. You ask your questions. I'll get to them all at the end, provided there's not too many of them. But if you want to also interrupt me, you can just send a little super chat, and I'll put that on screen, and we can talk about it right away if it's really urgent. And thank you for all for the support of and being here today. Okay, so without further ado, let's get into it. What was the first real experience I had? Well, it was a very subtle experience, and it didn't make much sense to me at the time. The first experience I had, because as a kid, you know, you're sort of enamored with the physical world, with learning how to crawl and walk and grab toys and throw toys and break things and build things. But when I was 7 years old, I didn't grow up in a traditional North American Christian household. I didn't know what Christianity was till quite a bit later, which is probably very common for people younger than me and people growing up today. But back in the 80s, it was very odd to not be a Christian. And so I grew up in a yogic cult, some people call it, but it was just my life. It was transcendental meditation in the community of Maharishi Mahesh Yogi. So at 7 years old, I finally was old enough to actually be initiated into the practice of yoga. And this was a big deal because I had grown up with my parents meditating 2 hours a day, every day. It was crazy if you think about it now, but at the time it was just like, it was like it would be for you going to church. If you went to church, you didn't think twice about it. Oh yeah, we go there and we eat the body and flesh of a god that we worship, and we consume him so he can cleanse us of venial sin. And if we have mortal sin, then we have to confess first and then be cleansed with venial sin. So that's the normal Western Christian cultural context. But I grew up in a Hindu cultural context as a white boy growing up in Steveston, British Columbia, which was a small Japanese fishing village just outside of Vancouver. And of course, the Japanese had a rough time during Second World War living here, and a lot of other people moved into the neighborhood. And then eventually we all left the neighborhood and other people came in. It's a constant flow of life. But growing up as a kid, I was very excited to finally be able to get initiated into TM, as we call it, transcendental meditation, my first real spiritual practice, because our parents would be meditating 2 hours a day. They would do their siddhis. In TM, there's the initial mantra, and then there's the adult mantra, and then there's the super magical advanced course that costs a lot and takes a lot of time and work. And there you learn the 22 siddhis that Maharishi brought forth. That's something I never did, but I did do the practice as a child, and then as the adult mantra that most people do. So my mom drove me downtown for my first initiation into yoga, into TM. And it was, a regular dark evening in Vancouver. And I was going to the TM center in downtown Vancouver to go through my initiation. And this is something you do alone, which is kind of strange and exciting and scary as a kid. Definitely, I felt very trepidatious because I would sit on their laps along with my littler sister when we were kids, and we'd sit there when we knew they were going to start doing the flying mantra, which is where you're channeling all this chi force down through your spinal column. This is my understanding of it. Of course, I'm not initiated into those practices. And you bring all your body and soul energy into the base of your spine, and it bounces you upwards, and you sort of, leap, fly, you bounce. And it's what's remarkable about it. They still have like competitions for this, even today in the transcendental meditation world. But what's interesting is my mom was clearly able to bounce higher than she should have been able to. So I think that's the thing they need to study, is how much extra bounce does those techniques give you? And of course, the legends in the tradition are that you can use them to learn to levitate, and that Maharishi levitated. I'm sad that there's no videos out there of gurus or swamis or rinpoches levitating, but maybe there will be someday. I'm certainly open to the possibility. So I was excited just to begin this practice, which consumed so much of my parents' time growing up. And at seven, getting initiated was absolutely thrilling. And I went into this TM center, which was very surprisingly, standard corporate office type space. It wasn't decked out with, Vedic or Hindu symbolism and decorations everywhere. It certainly didn't look like any kind of New Age space like you would see at a psychic fair or anything like that. It was an office space, and it was quite austere and bare bones. But I was taken into the main room where my godfather, Mark, met me and talked to my mom. And she went, I think she just went and waited in the car because it wasn't going to take too long. Either that or he drove me back after. I can't remember that. The thing that's burned into my memory is the initiation itself that I went through there and the experience of an alien consciousness for the first time in my life. And so he took me into this dark room in the back. There was candles and an altar, and there was these portraits, very colorful, very beautiful portraits that you've probably seen something similar to in the general iconography and image making of Indian swamis or rinpoches or gurus. And it was very much like that. So the first experience I had was there doing the initiation. He's calling, essentially doing a kind of ancestor type magic or a ceremony to bring in the guidance of Guru Dev. The Guru Dev is made famous in the Beatles song where they, across the universe, where they sing Jai Guru Deva. I believe that's the line, if I can recall. And so these mentors, these gurus of Maharishi are called to guide you as a soul into the practice of meditation, into the practice of transcendental meditation. You're given your mantra, and then you're taught how to practice that practice. And you do it there with your teacher after a lesson and the ceremony and the incense, and there's water and flowers and all of this thing. I've only been to my first two initiations back in 1988, and then I was allowed to do the adult one in 1991 when I turned 10 years old. And then I never continued in that tradition. I kept practicing it up until other Western practices that were virtually identical, in my opinion, replaced it. If you move on beyond that into the 22 siddhis and the advanced practices, then that becomes much more specific, much more individual in unique is the word in its practice and goals. And they've had to actually roll some of those back in recent years because some of the powers promised never manifested with anyone. And that's always a danger in promising powers is, what if they don't show up? Maybe you need to roll that back a bit and not overpromise too much. But yeah, I don't unfortunately, it was definitely thought that there'd be people levitating all over the place by this point in our human history, and it hasn't occurred. Other things have occurred. So the fascinating thing was, in that experience, when my godfather called these ascended masters to initiate me into this practice, it was the first time I had the sense of being watched. I don't know if any of you have lived in a haunted house or just had that experience out in nature. And sometimes you are being watched by maybe an animal or a person and you don't know it. But if you're in a closed room, it's very odd to feel like there's people around you watching. And that sense was overwhelmingly powerful. So that was the first time I actually realized that meditation might be more than meditation. Meditation might be meditation plus all these other things going on that we don't understand, an actual interaction between us and the spirit world. And that was an indelible moment in my life when I realized, oh, maybe this actually isn't all there is. Sure, we read the Vedas and other Hindu holy texts and yogic texts growing up, because we didn't read the Bible or anything like that. I didn't convert to Christianity till in my late teens. And that's a story we'll touch on briefly. But again, the focus today is going to be on just the obvious interactions I've had with what I would call spirits and non-human intelligences, leading up to apparitions and full-on confrontations with spirits that not only me, but other people in the room could see. So, yeah. All right. So that was my awareness opening up of non-human intelligence. And after I started the practice of meditating while I was walking around for 7 minutes a day, and then when I turned 8 minutes a day, and then nine minutes a day, and then 10, got initiated again. Very similar ceremony, just being given a different mantra. And these mantras are generally considered to be different for everyone, but I do believe there might be some more to that story, which we can get into some other time if you want to talk about transcendental meditation. It's not really my interest, but I certainly don't mind doing it if there's an interest for it. But the practice made me more and more aware. And the second time I realized that consciousness was different than I thought it to be. Like, how could I experience these other intelligences looking at me in a closed room, sitting there with another person meditating, and the sense that there really was someone there? But as I practiced meditation, and practiced it, especially I'd go to a friend's house, and, you know, we'd be playing basketball or looking at comics, and his mom would come out, and he'd, you know, they were meditators too, because it is quite a community. And she would tell us that we have to go into the parents' bedroom and sit on the parents' two separate beds and do our meditation. It was something just expected. I was like, why wouldn't we? So we didn't question it. We'd meditate. So I spent many years meditating with my friend Krishan, and he's now a film director. And we've lost touch over the years, unfortunately. But in those experiences, what I noticed was the awareness of another consciousness. You could sense his mind. And there'd be times where I would reach out to see what I felt he might be thinking as he's meditating. And when you're meditating, ultimately, especially if you're doing mantra meditation, you're repeating a mantra to the point at which you sort of forget you're doing it and enter a certain level of consciousness, a certain space in which maybe you're still saying the mantra, repeating it, but the mantra is more carrying you. And that's when you actually achieve meditation. It's not, as many people will tell you, the concentration on the mantra that is meditation. It's the consciousness achieved through the concentration on the mantra or the point in space or whatever it is that leads you into meditation and into that state of consciousness. So I would ask him afterwards, I'd say, were you thinking about this during meditation? And it's a weird question to ask someone, like, what were you thinking about during meditation? Because the obvious answer is my mantra. Of course, I'm just saying my mantra. But he knew what I meant, because in the state of meditation, while you're doing your mantra, occasionally you do have thoughts, even once you've entered into such a deep state that your thoughts are sort of suppressed or just you're beyond them. But if a thought comes in, it's the only thought there, and it's much stronger, and it's really noticeable in a room if you're meditating with just another person. And so I asked, were you thinking about this? And he said, you know what, I actually did think about this. And it just broke through his transcendental state and forced itself upon him. It was just a thought about a comic he had. I was like, were you thinking about this comic? He's like, yeah. you know? And I have a theory that a lot of the times when people try things like telepathy, one of the biggest challenges is just that zeroing in on a particular thought is too hard because we have too much consciousness going through our headspace at one time. And so it's very easy to just get overwhelmed by a jumble of things. But in meditation, you might practice perhaps isolating those thoughts more and actually being able to transmit them between people. So that was the second experience I had of just expanded consciousness, or consciousness being its own thing, its own reality. So these aren't ghost experiences. This is not poltergeist or anything like that, but we're getting there. Because the first realizations as a young person, it would have been great if I had seen a full-on apparition, I suppose. Maybe not great, maybe terrifying and traumatic, and I would have become completely shut down and never wanted to do this stuff again. So maybe it's good we don't see those things too young, or if we do, we forget them. But being aware of consciousness made me open to a bunch of possibilities that I think a lot of friends at that age, as you head it towards your preteen and teenage years, you start to discount and shut down, especially back in those days. Even though the new age was going strong in the early and late 80s and 90s, it still wasn't for everyone. It certainly was far less popular to believe in these things then, during the height of the new age, than it is today. We're in a second new age, you might say, but a different kind of new age. That would be a fun thing to talk about sometime on some podcast. Just going to take a quick break here to say thank you to everyone for being here. And thank you for the donations. That's very kind and very thoughtful. And someone actually had the Maharishi text, the science and being and the art of living. Yes, very cool. I mean, we can't start talking about Maharishi and transcendental meditation right now, or growing up in a yogic cult and community. I have lots of good things to say about it and some bad things, which I think I would have to frame delicately if I was to say them publicly, because my godfather still runs the TM organization for all of Canada. David Lynch would stay at their place when he was in town. I'm as into that royal family of Canadian yogis as you could be. And other than the fact that I became estranged by a series of choices in my life, both professional, magical, and familially. Yes, it's a topic for another time. How does that happen? It's interesting. Tight communities are great when you do what people want you to do. But yeah, okay, take a little sip here. All right. So that's just the very beginning, and it's taken me longer to get through it than I expected. So buckle up. This might be a slightly long one. A new dawn. Yes, you could say. So the new dawn happened in my life. So I'm meditating finally from age 7 to age 10. 7 minutes twice a day, doing it while you're walking around because you're a kid. That's how they do it. Then you're 10, you sit down. It's big. You get your big boy. When you're 10, you become a big boy and you get your sitting mantra and you just sit there and repeat it over and over for 1 minute for every year you are old. And you do that up to age 30. And then you do it for 30 minutes twice a day. And that's your practice. Beyond that is the cities. And that's a whole other package deal in transcendental meditation. So from age 10 to age 12 and 13, I was practicing meditation. My parents went through a divorce during that time. My dad met a new person who was extremely awful. And that's the biggest understatement I could make. So meditation actually became more important to me. I didn't actually abandon that stuff. I actually cleaved to it harder. You know, I don't want to go into any of the details of that era, but it was rough. It was rough. There was, by the age of 12, I was frequently depressed, staring up into oblivion and borderline suicidal, you could say. So rough divorce. Let's leave it at that for today. But it was during a family vacation. We would just go camping in the Okanagan in Penticton for family vacations because we weren't a wealthy family. We grew up in an affluent environment, went to private school was on fee reduction. And yeah, so we just would go camping I loved it. It was great. Penticton has great water parks, two beaches, two lakes. It's got the Ogopogo, which is like the Canadian Loch Ness monster. Very, very cool stuff. And they had this massive famous fire that year. You can still look it up. It just tore through all around the surrounding area of Penticton. And we were eating in Pizza Hut, I remember. And we came outside because there was sirens going off, because maybe the whole town of Penticton might need to evacuate. We might have to evacuate. And we really hoped we didn't, but we went outside and we just saw this massive fire. It was started by some people, as most of these fires in Canada are, accidental or intentional, both happen. Lightning strikes are, of course, are also common. So all of these things do happen. Let's just be clear about that. And the fire was incredible. It was just raging everywhere along the mountainside, doing tons of damage, destroying so many homes. It was absolutely awesome in the old school sense of that phrase. Full of awe. Awful. Awesome and awful. But as we sat there in the campsite when we went back, I just sat there late into the night staring up at it as it was happening. And ironically, there was helicopters, of course, flying over it with the Bambi buckets on it, dropping the water. And incidentally, those Bambi buckets are what pay for a lot of the Transcendental Meditation Society, or an organization in Canada, because my godfather Mark co-founded that company that makes the Bambi buckets. They invented the Bambi buckets. And I grew up getting to test them out at the shop and everything as a kid in the early 80s. So those Bambi buckets that, you know, also connected to my family, they were putting out water as best they could, but the fire was just out of control. And I was staring at it, and I had, for the first time ever, something I'd never experienced even in meditation, which was a physiological experience. It felt like I was on fire, and the fire just swept up me. It was like, it was crazy, because, you know, if you've never experienced sort of spiritual sensations in your body or energies or awakenings, then this is all nothing to you. But if you have experience, then you know what I'm talking about. And it just ignited the top of my head like a giant flame. And keep in mind, I knew nothing about Christianity. I'd never heard of Pentecost or any of that stuff. None of it. So I was just experiencing it like I was on fire, like my head was on fire. And it wasn't just any fire. It was this sense, this feeling of light connecting me with the fire on the hill. It was like I was one with the fire consuming the mountainside. But more than that, it felt like this fire was something that was everything, all the whole universe. It was like we were all connected through this massive fire, or this energy, this vital life force, this existence. And I think that might be the moment where I started to believe in God, because you don't actually have to believe in God to meditate. Obviously, you can just meditate. You don't have to have a theology behind it. But that was probably the moment where I started to believe in God, but I wasn't ready to call it God yet, because that would be so Christian. Not that I knew anything about Christianity, of course, but that seemed like a very Christian thing to say, oh, God. I just became awake to this subtle energy, this life force, this vital force that seemed to be everywhere and everything, and that I consider to be God. As a Christian, we would call that the Holy Spirit, but you could call it many different things, as you all probably well know. So that was the third major experience that prepared me for understanding that these things not only could happen to us as human beings, but that they opened up us to a larger world where spirits actually exist, where balls of light fly around in the sky, where people have experiences of abduction and missing time, and those things have happened to me. So we'll move along into the next ones. But that was that moment where then I woke up the next day and I was like, I need to become an occultist. That was just locked into my head from waking up as coming out of the dream state and facing that new day the next day. I just knew that was what I needed to be. Ironically, I didn't really know what the word meant, you know. So I went to the bookstore with my mom and took out some books on druidry that just sort of popped out of the shelf at me. Then we went to meet her boyfriend, who was very high level Amor guy, and he took us to his friend's shop, who was a Wiccan and had this Wiccan bookstore. And I had only recently heard from him, because they practiced magic, that magic was real at all. So I was quite excited to find out more about this and to go to this bookstore and find what it meant for me, where I could bring it into my life. Because if magic's real, why would you not want to be a part of it, eh? So we got some books. The main book I got was Celtic magic. We got candles, we got oils, we got all kinds of things, because, you know, it was our vacation, and you know, as a divorced mom, single parent, she wanted to give us the best time we could, and she definitely would see no problem with encouraging us to read. So we were able to get quite a few books, more than we'd be able to get as gifts or as holiday gifts if we were getting anything else. And so I got some books and read Celtic magic cover to cover on the 6-hour drive home to Vancouver. And set up an altar when I got home, didn't know what to do much after that. So I started reading her Wicca books and bringing in the Wicca practices. There wasn't many books on Druidry or Druidism back then in a how-to sense or with there's a plethora now, but there certainly wasn't in 1992 or 93. There was just, it was hard, less, you know, it was harsh days for Druidry. Of course, 21 Lessons of Merlin was out there. So I started incorporating techniques from Wicca. And of course, the irony of that is what I was actually doing is incorporating simplified aspects of Golden Dawn ceremonial magic into my Druidry, because I didn't realize that Wicca came out of the Golden Dawn. And if you're curious about that information, you can go read. There's an entire book on it called Wicca Magical Beginnings by our dear friend David Rankine. So check out Wicca Magical Beginnings if you want to see how Wicca was formed out of ceremonial magic and the Golden Dawn.
And now, a word from our sponsors. While we cannot control whether any ads get put in the spots allocated, we thank you for listening to those that do, since they help keep this project alive. You can also get ad-free content and bonus content and videos and a private webpage by subscribing exclusively to magicwithoutfears.com for only a couple dollars a week, or $6 a month, or $50 for the year. It helps a lot, plus you get emails about other exclusive things. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Actually quite a few comments here, more than I'm used to. Thank you all for being here, and we'll move on to some more stages in this journey. Now, sorry about the audio at the beginning. All right. So clearly I knew that this was my course in life. It was very surprising to feel like this would be my path, since I was very athletic. I was a sporty kid, you know, football quarterback, and, you know, basketball star, you know, then everyone got their growth spurts and left me behind. So thank God this revelation came that I was meant to do something else with my life. I would have loved to have continued being an athlete, but spirituality, magic, the supernatural carried me away with them. Though I never did see really a supernatural, because of my meditation yogic upbringing. It was taught to me that it was all just part of nature and the cosmos. I never saw these things as outside of nature, because you have to have a certain theological framework, a dualistic framework, to see God and nature as separate. So I was inherently very panentheistic, seeing God as existing in and through nature, but also being radically transcendent at the same time. So the next major experience that happened, we got into Druidry and Wicca, and I say we because I roped in two of my friends from public school into creating a little coven with me. Was it a Druid coven? Was it a Wiccan coven? Who knows? We were just interested in magic, and we were interested in celebrating the Sabbats as Wicca has them, right? So Lunasa, Imbolc, Midsummer, Beltane. These were the things that we could get together and create a little ceremony for. Mostly that was me creating the ceremonies, of course, but they were very keen as well. One of them had the Satanic Bible by Anton Zander LaVey, and I didn't want to let it work with him because of that, but my other friend said, oh no, it's fine, he's just into that because, you know, it's edgy and cool. And that made sense. Of course, when we did rituals together in those early days at age 13 14 15, they were always doing rituals for girls, because that's what young teenage boys want. I was always doing rituals. My intention for each ritual ceremony was spiritual transformation, for divine wisdom, for increasing my spiritual senses. And I was in a Rudolf Steiner Waldorf school, so I was also starting to read Rudolf Steiner seriously. I discovered a book on my family shelf, called The Outline of Occult Science by Rudolf Steiner. They've since changed the name to An Outline of Esoteric Science, which tells you something about optics these days, more so than content, because the terms are synonymous. They just refer to it in a slightly different way. Anyway, we did a few ceremonies, and it was at one ceremony that really the confines of my mind were blown open, when we did a midsummer ceremony. And we called all the fairy spirits, and we called them all. And I had started practicing by this point, having sort of hit the limits of what I felt Wicca and Druidry had to offer through the books I was reading. Again, we're talking early 90s, so very limited access to information. and virtually no real life people you could communicate with. You got to remember that there was no one you could talk to about this at all. You could spend every day lounging around in a bookstore, haunting a bookstore, talking to people, and not find anyone who knows anything about this subject that you're interested in. Even when you have a great bookstore like Banyan here in Vancouver, which was also run by a Waldorf school parent. So I was good friends with that kid as well. And we got a lot of books there. But we called all the spirits we could at this midsummer ceremony because we were wanting to have a great experience to celebrate my completing the course of work laid out by Donald Michael Craig in his book, Modern Magic. Now, Craig wrote that book before he actually was initiated by Chris Monastra and into the Golden Dawn and actually got trained in the Golden Dawn. So the book is great. I think a lot of people love it. I have a soft spot for it. My heart still have the first edition up there. And it's very good for getting people to do that kind of magic who have never done it before. But then it rushes things a bit, and that's where the book is problematic, in my opinion. So after I'd done the basics for about a couple of years, it started to rush me into this adeptus phase. And that was the ceremony that we were doing that night, was where I was going to take this vow to be a self-proclaimed adept of Don Craig's modern magic system. And so, you know, I wrote out the vow and made all the symbols and had done, you know, most of the preparatory work. Again, it's hard to do these things from books because you don't really know what to focus on and what requires less focus. So you do the best you can, but did I memorize the Hebrew alphabet? No. Did I actually complete the elemental tools? Not really. I had stand-ins for them, but not the exact ones that were outlined and described. And so there you go. You know, you need people there to tell you, hey, you can't move on until you've done this. But I didn't know that. I thought you could sort of use your own judgment and put it together however you want and things would be fine. That is not the case, as I was soon to discover. And this was the most shocking experience with the spirit I've ever had. And the one that also confirmed their existence for me verifiably and objectively in a way that I could never deny for the rest of my life. I sort of forgot about it for many years until I reread about it in my journal and was like, oh yeah, that was shocking. I can't believe I didn't make a bigger deal of it at the time. But of course, when you're raised to believe that these things exist and that spirits and entities are a part of existence, you're not that shocked when they show up, right? But maybe you should be. So as soon as we summoned all the fairies that night, the fairy spirits, elemental spirits, we just called them all in. We, you know, think of a bunch of teenage lads just calling all the spirits to them, you know, hoping their circle that they visualized would protect them. We probably should have had some salt circle, but, you know, we were in a living room and didn't want to make a mess. Yeah. And we noticed the spirits show up because it was like we were intoxicated. I had never been intoxicated at that point in my life, and not for many years after. They had been, but they both felt just jittery, like Christmas morning jittery, like the energy was so frenetic and high that we just felt like we were sketching out a bit, like tweaking. I didn't know those words at the time, but that was how I would describe the energy that entered that house high in the mountain of North Vancouver that night. But the shocking thing really came when I went to do the confirmation ritual of my Donald Michael Craig Modern Magic Adepthood in that system of ceremonial magic as he outlined it, not knowing much else about the tradition he was outlining, to be clear. I had lived when I was 10 years old, a few years earlier, next to the house we were doing this ritual in a big white mansion at the corner of Osborne and St. Mary. And that's where we were living after my mom and dad divorced, in an OTO oasis run by an EGC priestess and her friend. And there was lots of rooms I couldn't go into. So it was, you know, the whole OTO thing. And we didn't stay there very long. We left in the middle of the night in amidst chaos. So it was when I had some familiarity with the Golden Dawn, but not much. Rigardi's Tree of Life got mixed up in my books when I was there at 10, and so I got access to that book, but I didn't really read it. It was a bit too advanced for me at 12, 13 years old. But by the time I did this ritual, I thought I was really, you know, hot shit. I thought I knew my stuff. I thought, you know, here we go. Finally, after years of meditating, years of doing ritual work. I'm 14, 15 years old, finally ready to become an adept. Sadly, the spirits didn't agree with me. No surprise. Thank God. Who knows how to rationalize it. But, you know, I'd been doing it. Yeah, someone here in the chat says, how often does an adept do the LBRP? Only when necessary is the correct answer. But I was doing the LBRP a lot because that's what Donald Michael Craig foolishly told people to do. I should have been doing the LIRP. So a year or two of LBRPs was not actually doing me any favors. Fortunately, I was doing all the advanced rituals he outlines as well. So they sort of mitigated the downside of doing too many LBRPs, I think, of constantly banishing when you're also doing other advanced rituals. So I was doing them all, and I was really feeling the power and getting it confirmed from outside sources. Like, so I went from being very ineffective, let's say, as a young preteen, chubby goth kid with my classmates and with people I met. I wasn't effective. I couldn't really make a positive impact in them, no matter how I tried. They weren't interested in fantasy or poetry or fencing. And so once I stopped being a school athlete, people pulled away from me. But once I started doing the ritual work and, you know, LRPs, BRHs, all these other things, yeah, I don't think those are the rituals that really changed how people have related to me, but I'm not going to talk about those rituals today because I don't think you should just do them willy-nilly. So a lot of you know what they are, but again, I was standing in front of the altar in the circle, my coven mates behind me, and I was ready to finally do the key part of the ceremony where you take this vow. And as I was taking it halfway through, all of a sudden, I just felt frozen, and I felt like this intense pressure at my lower back, and it was like something was shooting a ray of energy into me. And not in a good way. I was just completely paralyzed. And I just fell to my knees. It was terrifying. It was absolutely terrifying. And I heard them make a noise behind me. And I said, what's happening? What's doing this? Please make it stop. And it made no sense at all. But my friend said, there's something outside our circle. We can see its form. And I craned my head and I saw it too. And there was this like ray of non-illuminating whitish light coming from it through the circle. Like there was no circle there, though we could sort of see the circle, the haziness of it in the air. And the spirit, we all saw it. We all saw this aura without a body just zapping me. I don't know how else to describe it. I could pull out the diary and read what I wrote, but I think a simple explanation is best when it comes to this. Something didn't want me doing this. They sensed, they didn't sense benevolence or positivity from it. They sensed upset, like I shouldn't be doing this, that it didn't want me to do this. And one of them said he had a very strong impression in his mind that the spirit was saying that I was not ready to do this. And it seemed odd to me because what was I really doing? I was just practicing a bunch of rituals in the book. It was making my life better, making people treat me better, making me a more successful student in school because of the added benefits of focus, self-confidence, and orientation towards details and systematic thinking. It really helps organize your mind and your soul in a lot of ways. Any sort of spiritual practice will do that. But it took me down, and they just did everything they could to, you know, they're visualizing energy balls and throwing them at it, doing everything they could. But I think it's only when I folded up the prayer, the vow, and in my mind made a shift that I wasn't going to do this and that I was going to seek help and I was going to find out what I was missing. Because clearly I was not meant to be making these sorts of proclamations, commitments, and vows at the stage I was at. There was something else I was missing. And there's a lot of ways to interpret that experience, but I don't think this is the time to do that. So rather than interpret what it means or where it led to, it is what it is. But it was an experience where something happened that was utterly unexpected, in no way anticipated. Like you don't, you know, if you saw someone act out this way when they were doing this kind of self-initiation ceremony, you'd think they were hysterical and, you know, unbalanced. But I wasn't. I was anything but that. I was the very stable, you know, reasonable, skeptical one of us. I was the most skeptical of us, which is why we did so many experiments all the time to make sure that what we were seeing was what we were actually seeing. We would create, you know, balls of light in our hand and make sure that both people saw the same color independently without, you know, without telling each other. And that those sort of exercises can really develop your psychic senses. For me, I was able to feel them, feel what color they were, though occasionally see them. And my other friends were very good at just seeing the layers of the aura, seeing them in color much better than me. But I was able to sense things. So they could go, like I could get put on headphones. They could go to any room in the house and I could just write down which room they were in. They'd come back and they'd be like, yep, that's where we were. So I could just feel where things were. But whereas they'd have a visual experience. So that's interesting. Let's talk a little bit before I contextualize this a bit, because there's other experiences to have, but this took way longer than I thought. Ghosts and spirits of the dead. You know, were any of these ghosts? I don't really know. I don't think so. You know, the popular idea is that ghosts imprint their souls imprinted on deceased people and they're lingering in certain places, often tied to unfinished business or traumatic experiences in life. You know, they're genius loci, spirits of a place. That's often how gods are treated. Ghosts, but gods as well. That's the whole point. There's gods of places, gods of the well, gods of the river and the stone and the rock. You see these places marked all over rural countries' landscapes, and sometimes they get transformed into churches or monasteries or temples of another sort. But there's this sense that certain spaces have spirits that are particularly powerful. And I think that was the case of where we were working at that time. But lots of instances in my life have these things have occurred where I don't think it was due to the space so much, but rather to the people involved. Poltergeists are another thing that people talk about a lot. A lot of people claim that these things happen all the time, not in my experience. I think, especially these days, given how much filming and cameras and security cameras there are, that if there was more poltergeists around, that we would see them. That's just my opinion on that, but I've never had experiences with that. Shadow people are things, again, it's a new term, not a term that I was familiar with growing up, but a lot of these things, I think, you know, are they shadow people because they actually show up as shadows, or are they shadow people because that's as much as you can see of them? That's something I'm quite curious about. You know, is it a lack of clarity in the perception of the clairvoyant that makes them seem like shadow people? But if you could see better, they'd be brilliant angels. Who knows? I don't know. But I've certainly seen my share of those. So that's something that I can definitely speak to. Sometimes, when I was working down at the church in California before COVID, I was sitting on the couch one night and I became frozen and I couldn't move my head. And when I finally did, there was this woman's face with black hair and just a white, empty gaze. And I told people around the property about it. And sure enough, this was a common experience. And some people believed it was the founder of this retreat center and church, Laurien Vignier. And that wasn't the sense I got. And also, it seemed kind of awful to imagine that the woman who had founded this sanctuary would become some sort of dark spirit. I thought that was kind of depressing to interpret it that way, but maybe that's what it was. Some people think she was unhappy with how things were being run there and therefore was haunting it as some kind of dark apparition. Let's talk about angels and demons now, and then we'll have to wrap up. The first angels I got in touch with. All right. We'll do this question before I get going. Do you think it's a wise idea to petition a spirit to develop the psychic senses like becoming clairvoyant and clairaudient? I'm thinking about petitioning Raziel to make me clairvoyant. Yeah, Raziel would be a great spirit to work with for helping you develop illumination. I don't know if it's particularly a good spirit for the psychical senses, but talk to it, see what it says. That's a very vast and mighty archangel indeed, and I'm sure Raziel could at least point you in the right direction. All right, angels. The first angel I worked with was sort of pointed out to me by a psychic my mom took me to when I was 13. And she said she sensed this spirit around me, this angel that was there to help me out. And she told me his name. And it was an old biblical name of a king. And so I started in my meditations, as I would be at the peak of my meditation, I started intoning the name of that angel through my being. And so I was doing this in my early teens, and I would just get to the highest point I could get because I didn't have much magical training. I certainly had no formal training, never had had a mentor or anything like that. I was just learning what I could from the books I had. But I would go to the highest point. This is just what made sense to me in my meditation, ascend to the highest point. And that usually involved getting to the highest point, staying there a while, and then searching for a way higher. It's almost like there's like a door in the level of consciousness that if you can find it, which sometimes means shifting something internally in your own soul or mind or being so that you can slip through into that next layer. I would just keep going up these what felt like worlds, you know, sphere after sphere. That's how it seemed at the time. Again, without language or theology or any system to frame this in. This is just how it seemed. And then I would speak that name, like let it flood my consciousness. And I would then sense the presence of that spirit in my room. And it was interesting because I didn't sense it like it was in me or talking to me in the head. It felt like it's over here or it's over there or it's back there talking at me when I communicated with it. So that was always interesting to have a locality associated with the appearance of that spirit. And this was apparently a, you know, one of the holy diamonds, the holy spirit, the spirit of the actual deceased biblical king. Maybe it's just an angel that has the same name. Hard to say. But it definitely had this very real person-like presence. And that's interesting, of course, because in Kabbalah, in the Tree of Life, in Malchut, the choir of angels is the Ishim. And Ishim is just plural for Ish, which means man. So the choir of angels of Malkut are the Ishim, men. And that's why in the Hebrew Bible, when angels show up, they always appear as men, right? Because that's what they were in the Hebrew Bible. And then there's other spiritual creatures as well, but those aren't called angels. They're just messengers. The angels are just messengers in that. And so we use the term now broadly to refer to all kinds of a range of spiritual beings. Even a lot of demons are actually angels, depending on what catalog of spirit you look at them at. Some people qualify Samael as a demon. Some call him an angel. And that's why this terminology is of limited use. Most of us consider spirits to be spirits. They're all, in Hermetic thought, dirty. They're all dirty because they're in creation. And the only thing that's not dirty in creation is the monad, is the father, is pure God. But everything else outside of that is slightly dirty. And so, you know, when you look at the differentiation between what makes an angel and what makes a demon, for me, the question is like, well, are we discerning between which is more dirty in this Hermetic cosmology that we might consider viewing them in? Or is it their function? Some people in some traditions at different points in time would say, well, the demons are the spirits of the air and angels are celestial. But like this is a much later interpretation cosmologically and occurred, you know, in the Middle Ages, long after people had been writing about their experiences with spirits, with daimones, with angels and demons for centuries, millennia before that. The Egyptians wrote about them. The Babylonians wrote about them. And so I would ask you to question the usefulness of terms like angels and demons. On its basic level, when you're working with spirits, maybe take them for what they are, for how they present themselves to you. Because I think these angels and demons, sometimes these spirits, sometimes are vast. Sometimes they're archangelic and complex, or their intelligences that just are like part of the operating mechanism of the universe, and they can then manifest to each of us differently depending on how we're conjuring them, how we're interacting with them, or the way in which our being lines up with part of their being. That could be the case as well. So that's what I have to say about angels and demons. But I can't go over all my experiences, of course. We're just getting over some main ones. I really want to give just an idea of what the reality of these spirits are like in my experience, in the most visceral way possible. Not conceptually, not theoretically, not within a certain system, but like what happened and how did it impact my life and how did I understand it and what were the results. So like when it comes to aliens and extraterrestrials, I had a very weird experience. The only thing that I could describe it similarly to is an abduction experience. I was feeling weird. Then I went into the bathroom one night and I looked in the mirror and there was this light in the center of the mirror. And as I looked at it, space closed in around me and it shrunk till there was just that light. And then I was gone. I didn't exist. And I came to only when my head hit the side of the bathtub, blood flying everywhere, just bashing my face. And I figured as I crawled back with my face bleeding, just, you know, in the middle of the night back to my bedroom, I crawled down the hall. I was in so much pain. I just figured maybe I'd eat something wrong. Maybe I was low in iron. You know, I'd been to the naturopath recently and she said she'd given me an iron supplement, but I don't think it was that because it happened again and then it happened again. And what really cinched it for me was when we were playing D&D one night with my friends and one of my buddies who was in the coven with me, he went to the bathroom and didn't come back for about 45 minutes. We were like, where is he? Wait a second. Where is he? That's a long ass time to be in the bathroom. You know, we were getting ready to make fun of him until he walked through the door looking like he, with a look on his face, like he had just seen a ghost. And I was like, I instantly knew what happened. I just knew. I was like, did you see a light in the mirror? He's like, and did you wake up when your head hit the wall or the floor? He's like, and he couldn't speak. And I told them then all about my experiences and we were all like, we don't know what to make of that. But I think it does line up most commonly with abduction stories. I don't think we were abducted at all, but something happened. Something happened that was not just maybe a lack of iron or eating something bad, because it happened too much. So I've never been able to make sense of those experiences, but I'll give them to you for what they are worth. Interdimensional beings. Well, I think all of these beings are interdimensional to some extent. Why do we call them that? It's just a modern term, perhaps. I don't know. I'd be curious what all of you think. Why do we call them interdimensional beings? We change the terminology as our technology develops. Excuse me. So, ancestral spirits. That is the one that I think I understood the least until recently when my sister died last year. And I talk to her all the time. I feel that she's around, but also moving a lot. And since then, I've become very interested in working with the spirits of ancestors and those who have passed on. As we get older, more and more people just keep dying in your life. And I never understood what people meant by, you know, they're never really gone. But now I do. And so I will have a lot more to say on that in the future. But I'm very pleased to be able to say that that has been a blessing to come into my life, is this awareness that, yeah, there's a lot more to what people mean when they say that no one's ever really gone. That's really interesting. And I've certainly been exploring that more seriously than I ever did before. So we'll have to do a whole thing on that sometime. And I'll definitely have to have my friend Dr. Megan Rose back to talk about that, because it's what she did her PhD on, is the relationships with certain kinds of spirits. Oh, that would be, and that's a great title, Kisa. Thank you. The Light in the Mirror. Thank you for being a channel member. That's a great title for it too. The Light in the Mirror. That would make a great short story. Yeah, were we ever here? That's the thing. Are we here? I mean, is this all a dream? I love the First Nation idea that we're dreams within dreams. Mythical. I love that angel talk. Yeah, it's lit. Let's go. Awesome. And also, we'll just go back through some of these comments. Cartesian dualism. It's an idea. I mean, I think there's definitely layers to experience reality. I look at things in terms of what we call in philosophy ordinal phenomenology. So ordinal phenomenology is what I studied. That's where semiotics led me. I started with, you know, traditional semiotics, understanding Ferdinand de Saussure and Charles Sanders Peirce. And this is what I was doing in high school and then in grad school, understanding the development of semiotics all the way up until Umberto Eco, who really with a theory of semiotics merged together the Swiss linguists' beginning of semiotics with the American philosopher Charles Sanders Peirce, spelled Pierce but pronounced Peirce, with his approach to semiotics. And one called it semiology, one called it semiotics. Now we generally use either term and we know what we're talking about. But Eco fused those together, and then other semioticians came along, like my favorite, Robert Corrington, who started looking at it in terms of ordinal phenomenology, which is the idea that our experience, phenomenology, which is phenomenological, is layered. There's different orders of experience. And so it's looking at metaphysics in terms of the layers of human experience, if that's the easiest way I could possibly explain it. But then it goes into looking at more complex ideas like the underconscious of nature or the pre-semiotic. Fun stuff. I encourage you to go look at ecstatic naturalism and the writings of Robert Corrington. Very great thinker, in my opinion. So, shout out again to the Ogopogo. All right. Oh, lots of highs and hello. Hey there. Hello. Hey, Arcanum. I don't know if you're still around, but thanks for stopping by. Yeah. Incipit Occultist. Thank you very much. All right. Yeah. Okay. We'll do a bit more and then we'll have to talk more about this another time. The main formative stories are what I really wanted to go over, and I'm glad I did. Animal spirits and totems. I did a lot of sweat lodges, or a few sweat lodges as a teen, as part of school trips, going way into the Chilcotin Mountains or into the Stein Valley for week-long trips, 80-pound backpacks, bear attacks, you name it, all that stuff, and you build out of boughs your own sweat lodge and heat the stones and sit there with the First Nation shaman we had, Saislam, and learn and do long, long sweat lodges, smoking tobacco and knick-knick out of the pipe, which was an interesting thing for the school to allow us to do. But in Canada, if a First Nations shaman tells you it's okay to do something, then no school teacher is going to contradict them, which is funny. I certainly connected with the totem. I don't know if any of you have a spirit animal. Let me know what your spirit animal was. But mine was certainly the raven. And the idea that the connection I had with them growing up was just very powerful because, you know, whenever they showed up, it looked like I always got the sense like they knew me. But it was the story that connected me most to them. It was the story of the raven turning black by swallowing the sun. And that was something that just I always felt was of special significance to me. The idea that by pursuing that thing, the greatest thing that we could pursue in life, or the thing that's most important to us, it will fundamentally change us into something that appears different to everyone else, but is still the same thing. And that's what the raven did when he swallowed the sun. He changed his appearance, but he was still the raven. So I don't have much to say on animal spirits and spirit animals and totems other than that. And certainly don't want to upset everyone who thinks that white people aren't allowed to have those experiences. That would be horrible. Trickster entities. Those are, I think I'm running out of steam here, folks. Light beings, orbs, sleep paralysis. I want to go over each of these. We'll have to do this again. Maybe I can do another stream tomorrow and get into this again because just running out of steam. I don't know how people do this all day, every day. Just stream nonstop. I guess they're maybe not talking the whole time, but that's it's. I certainly want to do it a bit more. I'll definitely be doing it a bit more for you all because it's fun, you know. And I have a better light than I had to get. get for a NokiaCon. Let's talk about that. We have our workshop coming up with Dr. Terry Burns here in Vancouver. If you registered for a NokiaCon 2025 and paid your dues for that year and are a member, you can come attend in person or attend online. You can still register and attend in person or online. It's not too late. Just go to InnokiaCon.com. This is something most of you are aware of that we're doing. And I'm very excited to be doing a hands-on practical workshop with Dr. Terry Burns here. And I will be doing the morning session where we will do an actual Enochian conjuration of one of the main Enochian spirits with everyone who attends, including the people who are attending online. So who knows, maybe if Dr. Justice Ledge actually wants to, he can do an Enochian ritual on Zoom with us. That will be a fun experiment, but it'll also mainly be a way to introduce people to the grimoire practice. So I'll start with a lecture, an hour long lecture on introducing grimoire ritual techniques of conjuration, and then we'll go into the actual ritual itself. Then we'll have a lunch break, then Terry Burns will do an afternoon thing, and then the evening we'll have a round table and some other stuff. So that's coming up. Check it out. And the announcement for 2026 EnochiaCon is coming soon. We have a workshop and a conference next year in Austin, Texas, and I hope I see a lot of you there. So I'm gonna end things here. And we'll talk more about spirits. Some of these stories took a bit longer than they did in my head. And I wanted to just do it from my own heart and my own memory for you, because these are the experiences that never left me, that sit with me and that form the foundation of decision, many big decisions I made in my life. And if you have some interesting spiritual stories of encountering entities, let me know, in the comments down below. Share some stories. I'll write back. I always respond. I always give my own thoughts. Or two cents, or just encourage you to keep going out there and experiencing the super sensible world. And let me leave you with one real reason why, because a lot of people say, well, what's the point? Why do that? Why experience the spiritual world and not just, invest in my 401k or RSPs or whatever you guys have in the States, the Roth IRAs? Why not just save money, retire, and die? Why not just do that? What's the point in experiencing these spirits and the super sensible world? In the Hermetic tradition, the reason is initiation and immortality. The mystery school teachings usually revolve around with the purpose of encouraging you to achieve immortality, which has to do not so much in the West with the physical immortality. In Taoism, it's physical immortality they're traditionally after. But in the West, it's more about, the immortality of the soul and the consciousness. So in the Hermetic path, in the way of Hermes, the ancient Hermetica describes that all you need to do to become initiated is just simply spend time contemplating and wondering about nature and reality beyond what we see with our senses. Just pure wonderment and awe and curiosity and openness to the mystical experiences of reality is what initiates you into super sensible knowledge, into higher consciousness. And in Hermeticism, of course, in the Hermetica, it's good to have a guide. Got to have a guide. You got to have at least someone to act as Hermes helping you out. And I've gone over extensively today why it was essential for me to join the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn at 15 and then practice learning from others so that I didn't just develop this solipsistic self-delusion of my own reality, which is just very easy to do. I actually shared a post by Dr. John Vivecki on my YouTube on the post section. He had a great little write-up about the dangers of sort of solipsistic Gnostic personal faith and religion. Spirituality versus religion is how he frames it. But I think all of you are pretty, if you listen to my channel, then you got brains. You could probably look at it and see where he's actually really on point about some of the dangers of having a self-defined spirituality without any sort of structure or system to bump into. As we say in the Golden Dawn, religion guides and regulates life. And I think that's what he's talking about, Dr. Vivecki, in his little write-up post, which it's a good read. And at the very least, if you're following an alternative spiritual path or a heretical Christian path like me, or whatever it is your crazy kids are doing out there these days, talking to aliens on DMT, probably, it's worth being reflective and analyzing and critiquing your own experience and looking at how it holds up against tradition. When I talk about tradition all the time, it's not because I'm a stodgy dogmatist. It's because I believe it's important to challenge ourselves, especially against everything we are certain of. Certitude is dangerous. Certitude is death. And thank you very much, everyone, for being here. Thank you, Kisa, for the beautiful donation. Much appreciated, everyone. Tons of bonus content on my channel now. If you want to become a channel member for a few bucks a month, I've got Invocation Writing Workshop. I've got many lectures that took many hours to put together and are there for you. And the question from Speed Altitude before I go, have you heard spirits loud and clear before? Yes. Generally, if I'm going to actually say a spirit said something to me, it needs to be loud and clear. Otherwise, I will write it up as, I think the spirit said this, or this thought appeared in my mind, which might have been the spirit, something like that. Or I might say, like, I was inspired with this thought. But if it's something that's loud and clear, I write, the spirit said this to me. That's what I write in my diary. And I might describe more about how it said that, whether I heard it like in the back of my head or whether it was overruling me. Like if you're in the middle of a invocation or a chant and then some voice just like breaks you out of it, like you actually stumble over your words because it's so loud in your head. Yeah, that's usually pretty much worth paying attention to. And yeah, I love the questions. Great questions today. We'll do this more. And yeah, what a fun time. Thank you, everyone, for being here. And thank you for all the support and love. And we're very excited for the holiday season up here in Canada. We're going to do it right. Do the whole magical Yuletide celebrations and have a nice workshop with to fulfill the commitments of the Arcane Research Society and give everyone who attended AnokiaCon a second thing included in what they paid for enrolling this year. And that's how we're going to do it with a workshop and conference next year as well. Great people have signed up to present, and it's going to be fun. So thanks again, everybody. I'll leave you with the wise words of the poet W.B. Yeats. If you're interested in doing Golden Dawn studies with me and joining my little temple, let me know. Reach out. Drop me a line, because I do have room for a few more students at present. Thank you and good night.
Hermetic Science Enterprises is a publishing company based in Scotland, UK, that specializes in Western esoteric printed literature as well as educational videos. With various imprints under its belt, its roster consists of grimoire tradition literature, alchemical works, Golden Dawn tradition books, and the several texts and videos originally belonging to the philosophers of nature. Besides its downloadable videos and standard hardcover edition books, Hermetic Science Enterprises also produces beautiful and precious limited fine edition books that are true pieces of art. For more information to order any of its products, please visit www.hermeticscienceenterprises.co.uk. That's hermeticscienceenterprises.co.uk. And as a lot of you know, I've talked with the publisher Lenny on the podcast before, including a six-hour epic extended version on the Patreon, and seen the fine edition of his new Grimoire of Scott's Discovery of Witchcraft, which is only available for purchase up to 50 limited copies till the end of May, I believe. So check it out now. HermeticScienceEnterprises.co.uk.
Give the gift that everyone wants, Omaha Steaks. Right now, save 50% site-wide, plus get an extra $35 off with code HOLIDAYGIFT at checkout. Save on USDA-certified tender bacon-wrapped filet mignons, perfectly aged ribeyes, gourmet sides, and decadent desserts delivered right to their door. Skip the stress. Order now at OmahaSteaks.com. That's OmahaSteaks.com, and use code HOLIDAYGIFT at checkout to get an extra $35 off. Hurry, these deals won't last. Minimum purchase may apply. See site for details.
Diving deep into the practices and reality tunnels of the esoteric and the occult, check out Praxis Behind the Obscure podcast, where I interview practicing occultists, do book reviews, and much more. Check us out on YouTube, Red Circle, and many other podcast platforms.